Thanks for listening to the AM 620 KPOJ podcast, sponsored by the Better World Club, providing travel services, auto insurance, and 24/7 nationwide roadside assistance, but not part of the highway lobby. This is Tom Hartman, Better World Club member since first moving to Oregon. Check out their eco benefits like the nation's only bicycle roadside assistance and their e-newsletter, Kicking Asphalt, at betterworldclub.com.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It is Friday, even though we're broadcasting from CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, and we're yesterday, we will be today. It wraps up tomorrow. And there's been some entertaining news. Joe the Plumber called for members of Congress who opposed the war to be shot. Another member of Congress, I think it was the guy who was introducing Mike Pence, said Barack Obama wasn't born in America, and Mr. Pence said, thank you for your, you know, wise introduction, or words that. Strange stuff going on here. But in any case, our first hour, as always on Friday, Senator Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie hour, sanders.senate.gov, his website. Bernie is an independent. He's not a Democrat or a Republican. And one of two independents in the United States Senate, and I believe was the longest serving independent in the House of Representatives in its history before that, representing the great state of Vermont. Bernie, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Always great to have you here, Bernie. What's happening in the Senate, and what's on the top of your mind?
Well, let me begin by saying that I think our right-wing friends are removing themselves further and further from reality. I think what most Americans understand is that this is a pivotal moment in American history. Our economy is in deep decline. Our healthcare system is disintegrating. The gap between the very, very rich and everybody else has grown wider over the last 7 years. There's great fear out there among middle-class families that for the first time in the modern history of America, our kids will have a lower standard of living than we have. And our right-wing friends seem to be drifting off into God knows where. But let me just mention that there is a lot of work going on in Washington. Let me just briefly summarize some of what's been going on in the last couple of weeks. We expanded the S-CHIP program, that's the Children's Health Insurance Program. Four million more kids will have health insurance. We dealt with an issue of work discrimination against women with the Ledbetter bill, which was significant. Most importantly, of course, as everybody knows, we passed the stimulus package. And what the stimulus package is about is that in the midst of the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, what President Obama and many of us want to do is create 3 to 4 million new jobs in the next 2 years in order to counterbalance the hemorrhaging jobs that we're currently seeing. In addition to the job creation and part of that effort, there will be tax breaks that go to the middle class. About 95% of working families will get a tax break. We have expanded health care for those people who lose their jobs. The government will pay about two-thirds of the cost of COBRA. We have greatly expanded community health centers so that hundreds of new community health centers will be built around this country, making health care available to millions of more Americans, including dental care, low-cost prescription drugs, and mental health counseling. We are all aware of the crisis in education and the fact that hundreds of thousands of qualified students that just can't afford to go to college, so we have expanded the Pell Grant program. We are also aware that states in my state of Vermont, all over this country, are running very large deficits. Some of them are beginning to lay off large numbers of workers who do basic services, whether it's police, fire, health care. And what we have done is significantly increase funding for Medicaid to help those states with their budget crises. We have helped local school districts by significantly increasing funding for special education, a promise made by the federal government decades and decades ago, but never kept. Special ed, especially with the rise in autism, is a very serious problem, and we have finally contributed a significant sum of money to help local school districts keep their teachers and make sure they were educating our kids. The main focus in terms of job creation will be to improve our crumbling infrastructure. I know in my state of Vermont, all over this country, Our roads are falling apart. Our bridges are crumbling. Water systems need a lot of repair. We can put large numbers of people to work rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure, mass transportation, high-speed rail. This is something we've got to do in any case, and it makes a lot of sense to do it now in the middle of this deep recession. The president, I think, has been very strong and consistent, both in his campaign and since he has been president, in talking about the absolute need to move away from foreign oil, to move away from fossil fuel in general, to make this country more energy independent, to address the crisis of global warming, and that is through energy efficiency, through weatherization, through movement towards sustainable energy. And I have recently become the chairman of the Green Jobs Committee in the New Economy, and we're going to be looking at ways to create millions of jobs over a period of years in wind, solar, geothermal, biomass, cleans up our environment, protects our people, and that's a very important issue. Just yesterday, we voted to give the District of Columbia a vote in the House of Representatives, about 200 years too late, but I think we're making a little bit of progress on that as well. So those are some of the things that are taking place. Also, obviously, what is on my mind and minds of millions of Americans is the disaster on Wall Street. We are continuing to demand, and this is not going to be easy, not going to be easy at all, but we are continuing to demand a thorough investigation as to how Wall Street got us into this disaster, how the greed, the irresponsibility, and I think probably illegal behavior on the part of a small number of CEOs at these huge financial institutions got us to where we are today. This economic crisis that we in the world are facing, Tom, you know, this isn't Hurricane Katrina. This is not an act of nature. This is an act of man, and it's an act of a relatively few numbers of people. And their greed caused this problem, and we've got to hold those people accountable. And as I've said before, it will be questionable whether our criminal justice system is prepared, in fact, to prosecute some of the wealthiest and most powerful people in this country who may have committed illegal activities. And we want to investigate that, but that's important. Yeah. I wrote a letter to, you know, when we talk about the Wall Street bailout, most people say, well, it's $700 billion. It is not just $700 billion. The Federal Reserve has lent out over $2.2 trillion to financial institutions, corporations. I have demanded from Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke the names of the companies who have received that funding, what the terms were, what the collateral was. And we got a letter back just a few days ago, which was totally unsatisfactory, indicating that he is not prepared to make that public, which raises the whole question of the Fed, the degree to which they act without transparency, the fact that they are moving, is spending huge amounts of money, lending out huge amounts of money with no accountability whatsoever. And that's an issue we want to work on. Over the years and recent weeks on this program, Tom, we've heard, as you know, from many listeners who are outraged that the very banks that their tax dollars are bailing out are charging them 25-30% interest rates on their credit cards, high student loan rates. We are going to be introducing usury law. We're going to bring back usury regulations in this country, which will limit the amount of interest that financial institutions can charge. And we're working on that right now. But the bottom line is we cannot allow these financial institutions to continue to rip off the American people. When we talk about where we are today, the reason we are where we are and what the bailout is about is providing billions for institutions, whether it's Citigroup or Bank of America, whatever it may be, who are quote-unquote too big to fail. Well, as I've said many times, if an institution is too big to fail, it's too big to exist. And we're going to be working hard with other senators to start breaking up these institutions so we're never placed where we are right now. Clearly, we have to re-regulate Wall Street. We have to develop a new Wall Street. It is not good enough for me to simply go back to where we were a couple of years ago. That's not good enough. We have to redefine the role of Wall Street, which is not just making hundreds of millions of dollars a year for the CEOs, the big bonuses and all that. It is to get money out to small businesses, to companies that are creating jobs and are working for the benefit of the American people. Got to deal with the mortgage crisis out there. So, in a nutshell, Tom, as you can see, this is a pivotal moment in American history. How well we respond to this crisis will determine, in my view, the future of this country for decades, and there's a heck of a lot on the plate.
Yeah, amen. And I'm curious, perhaps after the break, we learned recently, apparently from Harry Reid's office, that the filibuster isn't what we thought it was, that the filibuster rules currently, contemporarily, don't require people to actually stand there and speak. They can simply just sit there in the chamber and let music play in the background, and every 15 or 30 minutes say, I'm still here.
That's right. The word is usually, I object. Those are the magic words.
Yeah. So does that make it harder for us to, lean on Harry Reid to say,
no, it doesn't.
Republicans filibuster?
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. Okay. There are things that we can do, and there are things that we must do. I think the Republican Party is simply becoming an obstructionist party. I think more and more people understand it. All they could do is say no. They have no new ideas on how to address this crisis, and we're going to challenge them day after day after day.
Great. Okay. Thank you. Bernie Sanders is with us, Senator Bernie Sanders. We'll be taking your calls at 866-303-2270 right after this break. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Stick around. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line taking your calls at 866-303-2270. Bernie's got a great newsletter, by the way, and a great website over at sanders.senate.gov. You can check that out and sign up for it and get all that information. And, of course, our website, if you want to drop into our live chat room, I just got back in there myself, is at tomhartman.com. So, Bernie, ready to go to the phones here?
Let's do it.
Okay, Mark in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You're on the air with
Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom.
Hey. Listen, Senator Sanders, with respect to this thorough investigation, I certainly hope somebody takes a close look at the SEC. I'm an SEC whistleblower, have been for years, so it came as no surprise when Congressman Lynch from Massachusetts during the Markopoulos-Madoff hearings mentioned and described a special CEO SEC hotline to get the SEC to back off or to slow down investigations at the SEC. And there were recent revelations about Stanford Financial Group that an unnamed, unrelated agency to the SEC in 2006 got the SEC to back off on an investigation at that time that might have prevented or mitigated, these losses. What can be done to investigate the conduct, the suspect conduct of the SEC?
Well, Mark, you're absolutely right. It is not just the fact that Madoff was able to pull off a $50 billion Ponzi scheme, which, and nobody in the SEC apparently had a clue of what was going on. But the whole issue of deregulation in general, and the fact that almost until the very end, the Bush administration was telling us that the fundamentals of our economy were strong, while in fact we're at the verge of a major financial crisis, is totally beyond comprehension. So I think certainly we need to have an investigation of what the SEC did and did not do and how they turned a blind eye to everything that was happening. But equally important, we need to understand who the people were who precipitated this financial crisis. And how did they do that, and whether there were, in fact, illegal activity in terms of selling paper that they may have known was worthless. The difficulty of bringing the kind of investigation that some of us would like is that it goes beyond the Bush administration, and that, in fact, it's not just Greenspan or Phil Graham or George W. Bush, but you had leading Democrats, Robert Rubin and others, who were involved in that deregulatory process. So it's going to be tough. But I think we can't get to the roots of the problem. We can't turn this issue around. We can't create a new Wall Street. We can't deal with the culture of greed unless we understand what happened. But thanks very much for your questions, Mark.
Well said. Mike in Cleveland, Ohio. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good afternoon, Tom and Senator Sanders.
Thank you.
Tom, I think, don't rush me, would make a great bumper sticker. With the push for tax cuts, guys, by the right wing, my understanding is that if I'm not paying taxes, then any tax reductions wouldn't give me any more spending money. So how would tax cuts help the unemployed guys?
Well, first of all, many people who do not pay federal income tax are, in fact, paying taxes. They're paying Social Security taxes. They're paying Medicare taxes. Every time somebody fills up their car with gas, they're paying federal gas tax. What we need to do right now is put money into the hands of consumers, put money into the hands of working people who are going to go out and spend that money and create jobs by increasing the need for goods and services. That's what a stimulus package is about. And I think all of the evidence suggests that the fastest way you stimulate the economy is you put money into the hands of the people who need it most, not into the hands of the rich and the powerful. Many of our friends in the Republican Party still, if you can believe this, want to repeal the estate tax, which would provide $1 trillion in tax breaks to the wealthiest 0.3%. What Obama wants to do, and many of us want to do, is provide tax relief not for millionaires and billionaires, but for working families and the middle class, not only because that's the right thing to do, but because that is the best economic stimulant.
Amen. John in Los Angeles, on listening on K-Talk. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, Senator. You're a breath of fresh air. I have just two quick points, and I'll take your comments off on the radio, but one question I have is, they're talking this morning how Citigroup is struggling and their stocks may go below a dollar, which it looks like they're going to ask for another handout. And I want to know is, when are we going to say enough is enough? I mean, they bought smaller banks, and they've got a ballpark in New York named after them. And secondly, since President Obama has been elected, the right wing has done nothing but say he's not a legitimate president. And last night on Keith Olbermann, Sean Hannity, he pointed out that Sean Hannity had a poll on his website where he was asking his listeners what kind of rebellion should we have in this country? And alarmingly, it was most of the people that responded to it said an armed rebellion. I want to know, what can we do, or what can Congress do to, I mean, this is like yelling fire in a theater, and I'm concerned about this.
All right, let me take your second question. Well, I don't know if that'll have time.
We'll do it right after the break.
Sean Hannity and these guys are way out of touch with reality. The fact of the matter is, Obama today is a very, very popular president, and these right-wing extremists are increasingly isolated and further and further away from reality.
And increasingly angry about it, apparently. Senator Bernie Sanders with us, Brunch with Bernie, right back after this moment to stimulate the economy.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call
866-303-2270. Once I ran a big bank, I had it made, bundling that old subprime. And now that my fat bonus is already paid, brother, can you spare me another trillion? Wearing our Armani threads, gee, we look swell, full of derivative loot. But then we all fled as the stock market fell. I was the kid with the golden parachute. Remember my bailout? Okay, it was a con. I took you for a bunch of billions. Well, thanks, sucker, for the bailout. But now it's gone. Buddy, can you spare another trillion?
Yeah, another trillion, maybe two. Wouldn't that be nice? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. Bernie, did you want to put a punctuation mark on your answer to that last caller, or shall we move
ahead? I just want to say that in terms of the extreme right-wing guys, I think most Americans understand that they are now completely out to lunch, have nothing relevant to offer the very serious discussion we need to have. They had it for 8 years, And after their 8 years, the middle class was devastated. Poverty was increasing. Healthcare was in disastrous shape. We were in two wars, a war in Iraq that we never should have gotten in the first place. They doubled the national debt. So I think they should take a deep breath, calm down, assess what they did for 8 years, and give us a chance to move this country in a different direction.
Yeah. Amen. John in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, John, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Oh, thank you. Senator, my question is, instead of trying to solve the mortgage crisis by lowering the principal of a select group of people living beyond their means, which the mortgage industry doesn't like and the public doesn't care for too much either, why not get the mortgage industry to just lower rates to 4% for everyone? If you did this, it would help the whole economy. Anyone, including people living beyond their means, could refinance and lower monthly payments on their biggest expense. This would immediately put money in their pocket to spend on other things, stimulating the economy. And 4% rates would help the new and existing home sales market to revitalize that industry. That would
help raise values. Let me respond in two ways. Number one, I think your point is a good point, and actually we are looking at that, and I think you make a valid point. Number two, living beyond their means, quote-unquote living beyond their means, I don't think is a fair definition of millions of people who have lost their homes. Have some of them lived beyond their means? Have some of them been very wasteful in their ways and taken mortgages that they should not have taken? Of course. But on the other hand, understand that during the last number of years, the middle class has shrunk, wages have gone down, and what you saw, especially in minority communities, is these mortgage companies throwing loans, being very, very dishonest with these adjustable rate mortgages, and pushing these loans on people who should never have been given these loans, giving people loans who had no jobs, no income, with a full understanding they would never be able to pay off these debts. So it's not, I don't think it's fair to blame the victims. The primary people who caused this crisis were the mortgage lenders and the financial institutions behind them, in my view.
Michael in Miami, Florida, listening on WINS. Michael, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Senator, and thank you, Tom. I appreciate your show. Senator, I would like to find out, why is it that overall, in general, this is called a war? It's an invasion and occupation. And number two, we can reduce the cost of this occupation when we pay out tax dollars, a total sum of $775,000 per soldier per year to go and occupy other lands. I suggest that both of you watch The Charge of the Light Brigade. If you haven't heard of it, I'll be glad to tell you what it's all about.
You're talking about the old movie?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I'm familiar. Bernie?
Michael is, I presume, talking about Iraq.
Yes, Iraq, yes. And Afghanistan, well, yeah.
Well, you know, the war in Iraq is something that many of us oppose from day one. The president misled us into the war. Corporations made billions of dollars, such as Halliburton, with no-bid contracts. We have lost over 4,000 troops. Many, many more are coming home with PTSD and TBI, and this war has been, to my mind, an absolute disaster from day one. The end result is we're spending now $10 billion a month. The total cost will be between $1 and $3 trillion. So what we've got to do now is bring the troops home as soon as we possibly can and develop a new foreign policy, which is certainly not based on Bush's preemptive doctrines.
Valerie in Ithaca, New York, listening on WNYY. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi there. I don't think it's too early to start talking about this in terms of health care reform. I'm absolutely opposed to universal single-payer health care unless it provides equal coverage for holistic modalities like acupuncture, homeopathy, naturopathy, and chiropractic. I think that the United States can't afford to take care of all the sick people it has unless we reevaluate how we provide health care. And I think that, well, what my question for Mr. Sanders is, how can we change the health care system when the drug companies have such a chokehold on Congress? And how can we get research money to alternative modalities so that they can be demonstrated as valid and less expensive alternatives to standard healthcare?
Thank you, Valerie.
Okay, thank you, Valerie, for raising that important issue, which is worthy of a very long discussion unto itself. I believe in a single-payer system to be administered at the state level. And, Valerie, one of the reasons that I want it administered at the state level is to allow people more access to decision-makers in terms of the nature of the coverage. I happen to agree with you that alternative medicine, whether it's acupuncture or many other types of therapies, have a lot to offer. I remember some years ago we did a conference in Randolph, Vermont, and I was blown away. We had about 600 people out there. I think it was the middle of the winter. Deep interest in my state, and I think all over this country, in understanding the causation of disease in general, the environmental impacts that might make us ill, and also alternative therapies. Clearly, in recent years, we have seen a significant growth of alternative therapies into hospitals and into conventional medicine. You go to hospitals now, and acupuncture, for example, is often being used as a way to deal with pain. So to answer your question, Valerie, I think if we have a state-administered single-payer system and if people talk to their legislators and say, hey, we want to look at alternative medicine, we want to look at diet, we want to encourage exercise, I think we can save a whole lot of money and, most importantly, keep our people well. Too often, our healthcare system focuses on disease and treating people who are very ill, which is obviously important. But we need a similar emphasis on how we keep people well, and we don't do a particularly good job in that.
Sean in Vancouver, Washington, listening on KPOJ. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Senator Sanders, well, I consider it important that we prosecute Stanford and Madoff. I think it's even more important that we not let Henry Paulson off the hook. As you know, in 2004, when he was president of Goldman Sachs, he was one of the people that lobbied heavily to have the SEC allow the investment banks to take their leverage ratios, or what was called the net capital rule, from 12 to 1 to 40 to 1. But, Senator Sanders, the reason I'm calling today, though, is that as someone who is proudly Democratic Socialist, I consider myself to have those same sympathies. What is it like for you to be amongst all of these people who are quote-unquote pragmatic, who write people off, who are against the TARP Wall Street bailout as angry populists? I hate being thrown into that category. I'm not an angry populist. I'm a Democratic Socialist. What, do you have any comments?
Well, I do. I think, unfortunately, what media has done in this country and our educational system has not paid anywhere near enough attention to some of the real achievements that have taken place in certain countries in Scandinavia, Denmark, Finland, Sweden, Norway, some of the European countries who have made huge progress in cutting back on poverty, in providing health care to all people, educational opportunity to all people. Sean, last year we had the ambassador of Finland come to Burlington, Vermont, and we were both amazed. We had about 400 people out to hear him, and he talked about the wonderful child care system that they had, the fact that college education there, graduate school, is virtually free. Workers have 30 days paid vacation, and what they have created in those countries, and not to say that they don't have their share of problems. They do. Of course they do. Every country has problems, especially now. But what they have understood is you can't just have an unfettered capitalism for the survival of the fittest, that the function of government is to make sure that all people have basic necessities like health care, like education, like a secure retirement, like a certain amount of leisure, making sure that kids are not living in poverty. And I think we have got to pay more attention to the achievements of some of those Scandinavian countries, which is what democratic socialism is about. Let's harness the entrepreneurial spirit to create wealth, but let's make sure that all people in our society have at least a minimal standard of living and that we have a strong middle class, not just a situation where the top one-tenth of 1% earns more income than the bottom 50%, and that one-tenth of 1% have so much economic and political power as to distort the whole system.
Yeah, and it's only a few hundred thousand people. One-tenth of 1%. It's just a,
with extraordinary sums of money and extraordinary power. A caller before, Valerie, asked us about how you get health care reform with the drug companies and the insurance companies, and that's a really good question. These people are enormously powerful.
And need to be challenged. FDR was the last president to really do it well. And Hopefully Obama will. We're talking with Senator Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. It's Bernie's hour here at Tom, on the Tom Hartman program. Sanders.Senate.gov, by the way. Check out his website, ourstomhartman.com, for our free live chat room, and we'll be right back.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Sort of like our country is these days after 28 years of Reaganomics, and in particular 8 years, everything has got a dent, especially after the last 8 years. Bernie Sanders with us, Senator Bernie Sanders, taking your calls. And Bernie, let's see here. We have a call from Grand Rapids, Michigan. John, in listening on WTKG. John, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you. Senator Sanders, I salute you, and as part of this grown-up discussion, I would like to suggest two ideas for solving the problems we're in right now. One comes from a Dr. Robert McHugh, which is to say the rebate up to 3 years' worth of taxes, the idea being half of those taxes being required to pay down debt, whether it be credit card or mortgage, but allowing the front door policy in the front door with our tax dollars to take care of our own balance sheets, and imagine how that would stir the economy. The second part would be regarding mortgages, and this comes from John Hussman, a noted economist from the University of Michigan. And what he suggests is taking a mortgage and dividing it into two parts, one obviously restructuring the front end, and then on the back end, a par value, which would stabilize housing prices. If I could, I could give you an example.
Sure.
Say you had a $300,000 mortgage. You take that $300,000 mortgage and you turn it into a $200,000 mortgage restructured for interest rates, say at 4.5%. The remaining $100,000, you put at the back end, which would be a $100,000, what he calls a par note or a price appreciation note, which would mean that you have $100,000 that you do indeed still owe to the banker or to the authority or whoever it might be. But at the end of the day, that $100,000 would either be paid off when prices finally reappreciate at the time of the sale of the home, or down the road, even if you don't get enough to pay off $100,000, it carries with you down the road. Those in particular, those par notes could be grouped together and then also sold by the investment community, and they've become quite popular in the open market as well. Those are two, I think, solid ideas.
Good. Well, John, thanks very much for those thoughts. What I can tell you is there are a lot of very good ideas out there that my office and many other offices are considering. What we want to make sure is that the couple of million Americans who are in danger of losing their homes do not do that, and that, in fact, we do everything we can to try to stabilize the housing situation in this country. So thanks very much for those thoughts, John.
Glenn in Virginia Beach, Virginia, you're on the air and listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thank you. Senator, I was wondering, now that we have a new administration which claims to be hold itself, you know, higher morally and more honest than the last administration, will we ever have a reinvestigation or some might say a first-time real investigation of what happened on September 11th?
On September 11th?
Right.
I know that there are some people out there who believe that it was some type of conspiracy orchestrated, I'm not sure by whom. I happen not to share that belief, so I'm not sure that we need any more investigations of 9/11. I think it was Osama bin Laden and his friends, and I think we have to be vigilant against other similar type of attacks.
Might it be worthwhile to look into why the Bush administration was ignoring, Richard Clark?
Well, they're a generally incompetent. They're a generally incompetent administration. But my own view is, I don't think we need conspiracy theories there.
Yeah. Ray in Vancouver, Washington, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Tom and Senator Sanders, I appreciate you taking my call. I'd like to bring a point up about John Bolton jokingly made where you're at a joke about Chicago being hit by a nuclear weapon by terrorists or any city. My concern, I find that very worrisome and concerned because they're a party that, as you both have said, it was in power, and they're angry. And they're angry and they're frustrated at losing that power. And then you have people like this making these type comments. And number one, we're at a time where we still are at war. And they're joking about bombing the current president's home city. More importantly to me, I have family back in the Midwest. And there are people all over. And there's like 3 million people that they're joking and people were applauding
right.
for.
Well, that's a pretty pathetic, Ray. That is a pretty pathetic joke. No question about that. And I think Mr. Bolton might want to apologize for it.
Yeah, hopefully. Chicago being the home city of Barack Obama, I think that was the point of it. And that's really,
right.
really tragic. Mary in Portland, Oregon, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good morning. I'm wondering why the oil companies don't bail out the car companies.
That's a very interesting thought. Our friends in the oil companies have made huge profits in the last couple of years, as Mary, I think, is implying. In fact, I think ExxonMobil, Tom, earned more profits than any corporation in world history last
That's
year.
Right.
Is that right?
Even bigger than back during the Roman Empire.
Well, one thing that we have got to do is in fact, take a hard look at the oil companies and certainly at the tax breaks, the absurd tax breaks that have been given to them and make sure they contribute their fair share of taxes to the needs of this country.
Jolie in Portland, Oregon. You're on with Senator Bernie Sanders. We've got about a minute here before the end of the show, of this hour. Jolie?
Hello.
Hey, you're
Hi.
On here.
My name is Jolie Fay, and I am a small business owner. I make children's clothes, and I want to know why Congress is not hearing our plea to small businesses to revise the CPSIA. Do you know about the CPSIA?
Yeah, we do. Actually, Jolie, I can tell you that people are hearing it. As a result of changes in the sense of trying to make sure that our toys and the products getting to kids are safer, I think there have been some provisions in there which are very onerous in making life difficult for small business people. Is that what you're talking about, Charlie?
Yeah, but it is not just making it very difficult. It is eliminating opportunity in America when we are struggling as it is.
Right.
And
no, Jolie,
as we stand right now, it is still able to make a one-of-a-kind item. Because
Jolie, we're out of time. I'm sorry.
Right. That issue is being discussed. I think people are aware of it, and I hope that we can bring about some change very soon.
Yeah, I'd also love to see the Small Business Administration actually giving money to small businesses again. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov. Check it out.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Thanks for listening to the AM 620 KPOJ podcast, sponsored by the Better World Club, providing travel services, auto insurance, and 24/7 nationwide roadside assistance, but not part of the highway lobby. This is Tom Hartman, Better World Club member since first moving to Oregon. Check out their eco benefits like the nation's only bicycle roadside assistance and their e-newsletter, Kicking Asphalt, at betterworldclub.com.
To the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to our second hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the belly of the beast. Some may think that's Washington, D.C., but let's get even more local than that. We're at the CPAC conference at the Omni Shoreham Hotel, the only hotel I've ever been in where when you call the front desk and say, I can't get the internet in my room, when you check in, they say, hey, you're one of our regular, most honored guests, because I'm a member of their program. And they say, you get free Wi-Fi. I said, I can't get it in my room. And they say, well, your room isn't one of the ones that gets it. With a laugh. It's so bizarre. Why Dan Gaynor with us, the Vice President of the Business and Media Institute, T. Boone Pickens Fellow there, businessandmedia.org, the website, and regular on the show. And, Dan, it's great to sit right across the table from you.
Yeah, it's much better to do this in person.
I agree.
Yeah, I certainly, if I were running in the hotel, I would have made sure you had Wi-Fi.
I'm just curious, why. And, in fact, when I was checking in, there was some woman who was just reading the riot act to the person, behind the desk about how her Wi-Fi wasn't working in her room. And they were basically saying, well, some rooms just don't have it. And it was like, what?
Well, based on the large attendance, because I think this is much bigger than it's ever been before.
9,000 people.
Yeah, I think it used to be around 6,000. So that's like a 50% increase.
Yeah, I think it was 3,000 the first year I was here. It was like 4 years, 5 years ago.
Yeah, they were already planning on moving to a new location next year, and I'm sure it will be optimum for Wi-Fi, internet,
Wi-Fi functional
everything.
Hotel.
No, I mean, I think it's grown. This shows. I mean, one important thing, it shows that the conservative movement is not just rolling over and playing dead and letting Democrats and liberals run Washington. They're saying, okay, we didn't like the way things ran last election, so they're turning around, and clearly they're turning out.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really quite remarkable. Right across from us, if you just turn your head slightly, you can see there's a 3-foot-tall picture of Sarah Palin's face. TeamSarah.org. Mitt Romney was sitting 3 feet from me for about 15 minutes this morning as he was talking with Joe and Mika next to me, and with his whole entourage, and it was like a rock star was in town, and all the Brill cream in his hair. It was really, I'd never seen him up close. He's kind of weird looking up close. In my humble opinion, I guess I'm just not into Brill cream, or whatever it was, wax or something. But it's like, there are all these candidates. There's all this stuff going on. I want to talk with you about the stimulus package. That was our topic du jour. But I'm curious, as a conservative, as a Republican, what do you think of the Republican field? We're hearing that Jindal shot himself in the foot the other day. But on the other hand, Bill Clinton did an even worse job back in, 84 at the Democratic convention? And he ended up as president.
Yeah, I think Jindal certainly had a bad coming out party. It was not a great speech. It was not well delivered. I think it was the wrong message. It was sort of an introductory message. Here, I'm Bobby Jindal. Here's who I am. That's a fine message for certain venues. It was not the message I think conservatives really wanted to see. They wanted to see a little bit tougher talking, a little bit more punch to the speech. But, hey, let's face it. Who wants to follow Barack Obama as a speaker?
Yeah.
I mean, that's like saying, oh, guess what? We're going to put you in the lineup for a concert. You get to follow the Rolling Stones. Oh, and maybe we'll get Who together and bring back the Clash.
And maybe I saw Itzhak Perlman as well.
Yeah, we're going to hit all the different categories you don't want to follow. Clearly, Obama's speech was inspiring the other night. I think it was very weak on details. I'm not the only one who thinks that. I think a lot of Americans think that. I think the stock market thinks that. But he gives a good speech when he's into it. I thought it was vastly better than his acceptance speech for the Democratic Party.
Yeah, well, so the bottom line is, who do you, there's this straw poll that's going around. I don't have my copy here right in front of me, but it's got a list of, Republicans. Pick one.
If I were to pick the person I would probably pick most would be the 3-foot poster behind us, would be Sarah Palin.
Really?
But Jindal, I've heard
I'm
great things.
I'm surprised you're not a Mitt Romney guy.
I was going to say, I've heard great things about Jindal. I think I don't rule out Mitt Romney. I think Mitt Romney learned one of the things that's classic for, if you're Republican from a state where it's much more liberal, you have to run to the right. He learned something that, frankly, John McCain refused to accept. And John McCain ran to the right in fits and spurts.
Yeah.
And as a result, he didn't really have a lot of the diehard conservative appeal.
I think he lost a lot of that a lot earlier with his immigration positions.
His constant attempt to be a maverick.
Right.
Well, a maverick basically is a guy who will tick off his own side sooner or later.
Well, a maverick is kind of a cow that's gone crazy, isn't it?
Or a horse.
Left the herd,
Yeah, and he clearly had antagonized conservatives many times down the line. When you're running for president, theoretically, as a standard bearer for, and there's a big difference between Republican and conservative. We're conflating them right now, but there really is a difference.
Yes.
And I think that's one of the things that CPAC is all about this year.
Well, in fact, that's one of my big questions. I mean, just not certainly a question for you, but I mean, in my mind, one of the things I'm really grappling with is I've been on this earth long enough to see the Republican Party go through a series of incarnations, from Barry Goldwater when it really was the conservatives, they took it over, to Richard Nixon when it wasn't, it was totally pragmatic. Richard Nixon was more liberal in many ways than Bill Clinton, to coming back to the conservative movement with Ronald Reagan, to losing some of that, but having purged all their members of Congress. I don't think that there are any outside of the, you know, Susan, in the Senate you got a couple, but in the House of Representatives, I don't know of any House members who are not, you know, right or far right. And, you know, Newt really did a good job of that purge. And, but it seems that the party might be well served to be going back to its Rockefeller, you know, the Nixon kind of middle ground area. And yet the conservative movement is like, no, no way. We're not going to let go of this thing.
Well, that's because a lot of the people who are running the party right now are people who do remember what it's like to have an inspiring leader, Ronald Reagan, who believes actually in principles. And George Bush, love him, hate him, it doesn't. I know that a lot of people on the left just, you know, just saying the words. It's like cursing on talk radio. But that's a lot of conservatives are disappointed in one of the key things that George Bush did, which he went spending crazy.
Well, and so did Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, not anywhere near a comparison. George Bush understood
one thing. Say it's in the same ballpark. Reagan ran up a $3 trillion debt, and so did Bush.
Bush decided that the way to get a lot of these things, particularly after 9/11, the way to get them through Congress, particularly through, you know, borderline Congress, and then after Congress particularly became Democrat,
was to scare the hell out of us.
But also just to lard things up with, you know, look, the number one agency that grew was Education Department.
Well, you realize his brother is in the business of selling testing materials to schools that are mandated as a consequence of No Child Left Behind. When his mother gave $30,000 for Katrina, she mandated that it had to go to his brother's charity or his brother's corporation to buy those testing materials for the schools. And, you know, I mean, it's just this whole incestuous weirdness with No Child Left Behind.
I mean, it's not just with No Child Left Behind. I mean, let's be honest here. This is Washington, D.C.
Oh, yeah. Democrats were there, too.
Well, I was going to say, Democrats are everybody in the city who runs things. And that's currently the party in power, runs things by, it's not just what
but,
you know.
But my point was that Reagan, you know, you're saying you want to get back to Reagan. Reagan never practiced what he preached. Reagan, you know, Reagan invaded a country that represented several, actually, that it represented no threats to us at all. I mean, it's not like Grenada was about to launch a nuclear missile strike against us. Reagan ran up the biggest debt in the history of the United States. He borrowed more money than every president from Washington.
Reagan fought the Cold War. Successfully.
He did not fight the Cold War.
He
bought a bunch of Star Wars stuff that the Soviets didn't even bother to try to match.
He fought a Cold War without, basically, I wouldn't say without firing a shot, because people will die even in the Cold War if you read some of the...
The Soviet Union was falling apart, and Afghanistan was what put the nail in their coffin. Arguably, Osama bin Laden brought down the Soviet Union, not Ronald Reagan. If you want to give credit
to
somebody...
The United States helped for Mujahideen, the United States pushing the Russians, or the Soviets at the time, on a lot of fronts, certainly helped push the Soviet Union into its crumbling little bits.
But it crumbled on Bush Sr.'s watch, not Reagan's watch. Why don't you give him the credit?
Because
quite as charismatic?
No, because it was done on Reagan's watch. I mean, it's like...
Well, then why
like
don't you give Jimmy Carter credit for it, too? Jimmy Carter jacked up the number of nuclear missiles we had by almost 1,000. He actually spent more money that the Soviets had to match than Reagan did, because Reagan wasn't putting money into Soviet missiles. He was putting into Star Wars, and the Soviets were looking at that going, Star Wars? What, you think we're crazy?
If you want to talk about how much money Carter was spending, it's only because Carter also helped boost the interest rates up to like 18 or 21%.
That was Paul Volcker. I mean, that was the Fed. Jimmy Carter didn't have any control over that. You go back to, you know, remember Lyndon Johnson taking the chairman of the Fed in his office, grabbing him by the collar and slamming him up against the wall? President can't talk to the chairman of the Fed.
But president also affects the economy. And, I mean, there was a reason why Jimmy Carter got thrown out after 4 years.
Yeah, because he couldn't get the hostages out of Iran.
Yeah, not just because of that. No, certainly.
Four weeks before the election, he was ahead in the polls.
He lost. It wasn't just... There's no one political thing is ever just the political thing, the reason why somebody wins or loses.
Yeah.
And the economy... And people still look back at the Carter years and remember the... Was it the pain index? Misery index. That's right.
Misery index.
Yeah. And the misery
We need that back.
It would be low right now. It would actually be low because unemployment's low and inflation's low.
Unemployment is low the way that they're calculating it these days. But if you go back and calculate it the way it was during Carter's time, it's higher than it was during Carter's time.
But if you calculate the change, during Bill Clinton's time?
Yeah, exactly. I'm not trying to pin this on you guys. I'm just saying, you know, they've been messing with the numbers for a long time, and it's not helping any of us. Stick around, Dan. Okay. I want to talk with you about the stimulus, and since I've got you here, and then we'll pick up some phone calls and carry on with the day. Dan Gaynor with us, businessandmedia.org.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows anything goes.
Anything goes Friday. We'll be getting to your calls in just a few minutes, but two wild and crazy ADD guys here, Dan Gator and Tom Hartman. On opposite
you know me
sides
too
of the
well. Fence. What can I say?
Hey, I'm a trained observer here, Dan. Dan Gaynor is the Vice President and T. Boone Pickens Fellow at the Business and Media Institute, businessandmedia.org, the website, conservative think tank. And Dan, the economic stimulus, the economy. We have a Republican president, George Walker Bush, George W. Bush, before he left office. We have a Republican Secretary of the Treasury. And Republican appointee who is the head of the Fed, and they're all using language like Great Depression. And so Obama comes along and he says, okay, we're going to do something about this. Your take on what he's doing?
Well, first of all, my take would be, we're not hearing both sides. If you look at the
what's the other side?
Well, the other side is the stimulus plan was bad. Is a bad thing for the economy. The other side is...
I've been hearing that all over the place. It seems like there are more Republicans. In fact, there are more Republicans being interviewed on TV on this topic than Democrats.
Only on the cable news shows, not on the regular broadcast. You watch regular broadcasts, and I did, because I looked at...
By regular broadcast, what are you talking
ABC,
about?
ABC, CBS, NBC.
You're talking about the evening news.
Evening news shows.
That are only watched by people over 65.
Well, the people over 65, the 20-some million people who watch those shows, they vote a lot. And they were really uninformed because they were reliant on news that was giving them by a ratio of 2-to-1 pro-stimulus voices. And it's not just politicians they're turning to. I mean, this is a major economic issue, right? So who do you go to? You should go to economists. What do you find? You find that by 4-to-1, they rely on pro-stimulus economists. So then
well,
you're getting...
That might have something to do with the fact that, for example, the most recent Nobel laureate in economics, Paul Krugman, is saying... You know, not only is he agreeing with you, the stimulus package isn't going to work, but for the opposite reason, he's saying there's not enough here. You're trying to fill a $2 trillion hole with $800 billion.
Every time he writes a column, he thinks the number should go up. I mean, literally, I mean, he's been tracking consistently going up.
That's because the economy's going down. Yeah. It's going down fast.
But if you look at let's look at Cato. Cato Institute, which is represented
Libertarian
here,
think tank, yeah.
Ran an ad that ran in the New York Times, Washington Post. So places where actually network news producers look. And they had 250 economists in the initial ad, including 3 Nobel laureates, saying the stimulus plan is bad. Now,
Cato's answer to it, though, is the exact same thing Herbert Hoover did. Hands off.
Well, that's actually not the exact same thing Herbert Hoover did. You know this. Herbert Hoover actually got the government involved. It was a combination. It's never just... I mean, everybody says, oh, the Great Depression was made... You know, it's Herbert Hoover.
Hoover did virtually nothing. It was in the third year. It was 1930, late 1930, when he finally got Smoot-Hawley through. He finally, you know, 31 when he started some of the programs. But you know...
It was a combination of the things that Hoover did and FDR did that made things worse.
But he was following Mellon's advice, which was, you know, let it all collapse, you know, let it liquidate. Liquidate labor, liquidate business, and better men will pick it up and put it back
together. They didn't just let it all collapse. They, of course, also, you know, set up trade regulations, which initially one of the things Obama was talking about doing that pleasantly when he was in Canada the other day. He says he's now backing off of restraining trade because that...
Well, Hoover didn't set up trade. All he did, he raised existing tariffs from in the 30s to in the low 40s.
Right. He boosted tariffs.
But at that time, trade was only 4% of our total GDP, and it only went down to 2.5% of our GDP as a consequence of arguably the Great Depression, not Smoot-Hawley. I don't think...
But it is one of the things... I mean, there's like a... I guess almost a playbook, you know, if you want to talk NFL, you know, a playbook of how not to handle the deep economic recession. And one of the things was restraining trade with tariffs. One of the things is boosting taxes. You know, those are things that we're now seem to be doing with great abandon. If you look, Wall Street Journal had a great piece the other day talking about the budget, because now we're the budget land.
Hang on just a second. Let me just back you up. You know, you said don't boost taxes and don't restrain trade with tariffs. And as I said, you cannot demonstrate that Smoot-Hawley had any negative effect. Trade was only 4% of our GDP.
And dropped to 2.5%.
And dropped to 2.5% over the following 2 years, during which time our GDP contracted more than 4 or 5%. I mean, it was... Actually, I think it was more like 7%. It was not trade that was killing our GDP. It was the fact that nobody had any money to buy anything. was, you know, Smoot-Hawley, and you know, we've had tariffs in this country from the founding of this country. Secondly, the raising taxes. How does raising taxes on millionaires and billionaires? I can see where, arguably raising taxes on average working people, like Ronald Reagan did,
we're not going to raise taxes on working people. The Wall Street Journal lead editorial yesterday talked about how to raise the money that Obama needs in 2010 budget, you're going to need not just every penny that the 250,000 plus make, but every penny that the 75,000 plus, everybody makes $75,000 and above based on 2006
budget. That's assuming you do it entirely on income taxes.
Yeah. What the Wall Street Journal
was leaving out of that equation was the possibility of taxing people who make a living sitting on their butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive at the same rate that you and I are taxed for actually working for a living.
And that's still not going to equal it. They're still talking about it. And Congress is talking about taking mileage taxes.
If you take capital gains and dividends and tax them at ordinary income rates right now, it'll solve that problem.
You're going to discourage investment, and then you're going to drive the market even
You're going to discourage speculation, and you won't have any more bubbles.
You also won't have any more investment right now.
Of course you will. Back in the days, come on, for most of the history of the income tax, capital gains were taxed at the same rate.
Dow has already lost 25% under Obama. Let's not go for another 25%.
Are you telling me that during the Eisenhower administration, when that was the case, there was nobody investing in businesses?
Was the economy as bad as it is right now during the Eisenhower administration? No.
It was solid.
You don't want to drive the economy down when the economy is already down.
Okay. All right. I'll let you get the last word.
Okay.
Dan,
that's a novelty.
That's a novelty. Dan Gator. The VP of the Business and Media Institute, businessandmedia.org. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you very much.
Great having you here.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Some of that.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour, broadcasting live coast to coast. And John Thelmy is with me. He is the chief economist for the American Petroleum Institute, API. What's the website for that? Is it
API? www.api.org.
API.org, the American Petroleum Institute. I'm assuming the American Petroleum Institute, forgive my not knowing a great deal about it, although I know we've talked before on this program, but right off the top of my head, that you're basically the advocacy group and lobbying wouldn't, you're not a PAC, but the advocacy group for the petroleum industry. Is that?
That's right. We're a 501c6 organization. As such, we do several things for the industry. Near and dear to my heart as an economist, we have statistics, of course. Mm-hmm. We've got standards and quality programs, training programs for the whole industry. And then, of course, we have our advocacy and our lobbying efforts.
Right. And you mentioned, we were talking before the break, you're a registered Democrat. And my question, what's a registered Democrat doing here at CPAC? And does the message of API transcend partisanship? I mean, is that?
We're a nonpartisan organization, and in fact, we're a sponsor here of Radio Row because we want to see the facts out to everybody. Mm-hmm. We engage with all parties. We engage with all organizations. Our mission is these are what the facts are, and then we think proper energy policy will follow.
Well, let's get to the facts. Why did the price of oil go from $30 a barrel to $140 a barrel and back down to $30 a barrel if there isn't something very, very dysfunctional in our commodity trading system, and basically a cartelized set of small cartels, OPEC being the one that's most obvious. In fact, they call themselves a cartel, producing the antithesis. You describe yourself as a libertarian Democrat. I would think that a libertarian would be very, very opposed to the essentially monopoly system that your industry is a part of.
Well, we're not part of monopoly. There is clearly a cartel, as you mentioned, OPEC. It's not clear how much they played a role in terms of the increase in price.
Right.
If you look before the Olympics and after Olympics, the world was much, much different. Before the Olympics, we had strong economic growth around the world, including here in the United States. We had Chinese economic demand to keep the lights on for the Olympics. If anybody saw the opening ceremonies, you know how important that was to them.
Yep.
You had fuel demand because of the earthquake. And then after the Olympics, everything changed. And so what you saw was a price run.
Why?
Well, because first of all, you had the post-Olympics demand decline. Second of all, you had a world shift in terms of the credit collapse, in terms of everything. So it was fundamentally a shift in demand. And since our economists would argue that supplies are so tight, in other words, the price elasticity is so low, you can have disproportionate increase in prices. Now, the question is, was there some other cause in terms of why did the price go up? In other words, was it speculation or manipulation or whatever?
Right.
You know, as an economist, we tend to look at it from Econ 101. We know that on any given day, any given series of days, while the futures contract is being traded before the close, it can be anything that they think it is. In other words, it could be pure speculation in a sense. It's whatever the market participants buying and selling think it is.
Right.
But when the contract closes, real prices equal futures prices. The wet barrel prices equal futures. And so then you say, well, is that wet barrel price wrong? And I mean, this is, sorry to go into deep economics, but think about Econ 101 with this intersection of supply and demand curve. If you believe that that price...
But this had nothing to do with supply and demand.
Ah, yes, it did. Let me explain. Well, let me explain. Think of the intersection of supply and demand curves. If you believe that that price is artificially high, then you've got a situation where supply is greater than demand. If that's true, okay, let's just say it is, then what will happen? Inventories will accumulate. We didn't see that. So if you look at the fundamental data, it supports that it really
but
was...
But couldn't you argue we didn't see that because people were holding oil off the market?
Well, that's the question. Worldwide, we don't have good enough statistics outside of the U.S., OECD, to know really what's going on.
Because at $140 a barrel, a lot of countries that... You know, we're making political decisions, political economic decisions, and control their own oil supplies as opposed to countries where they just have a deal with Shell or something and you know, a private corporation is pumping it. They're saying, you know, hey, $140 a barrel, we can drop our production 20%,
well,
still make,
you know,
more money than we were making six months ago.
That's an interesting point. George Soros, who I don't agree with on much, articulated it could be a backward-bending supply curve. And that's what you're arguing.
Yeah.
However, if you look at the production capacity, if you look at the excess capacity and so on, it was virtually zero. At $147, everybody was pumping out every drop they possibly could. So I don't subscribe to the notion. Now,
so then why did the price go back down?
Because demand shifted. You had a fundamental drop in demand. If you look at demand in the United States, starting in June, demand for diesel turned negative. Gasoline demand had been negative for most of the year.
So do you think that as a consequence of this, you think that you're going to see oil at $12, $14 a barrel? And also, why has the price of gasoline only gone down to $2 a gallon? And while oil is back down to $30 a barrel, where it was when gas was $1.10 a gallon?
You got to do the arithmetic on that one, and nobody does the arithmetic. First of all, to deal with that, if you look at what happened, you had, for example, crude oil prices dropped from $147 a barrel to $33 a barrel, or about $2.65 a gallon. Nobody knows there's 42 cents in a gallon, so people try to compare percentage changes. You can't do that because of the tax wedge in gasoline taxes. So what you have to do is convert to cents per gallon. Crude dropped 265, gasoline dropped 250, but it didn't go up as much as crude did, so it's not surprising. So today, if you look at what's the price of crude oil today, it's about $1.07 a gallon. Historically, if you look back, say, 10 years, the differential between a crude price and a retail price is about 98 cents. 45 of that is taxes. So, no, what you've got is crude prices and gasoline prices moving together. The Department of Energy yesterday also pointed out that people look at the West Texas Intermediate, and that's not real measure.
No, I read that article, yeah. But that's
you know,
an
things
anomaly.
Are not out of line.
But how, you know, then how is it, you know, and I find this fascinating to hear your take on this. How is it that ExxonMobil consistently for the last couple of quarters has been the most profitable corporation in the history of the world? I mean, going back to the Roman Empire. How is it that they are so profitable when we have things in place like the Sherman Antitrust Act that say that, you know, when corporations reach a certain size, they're toxic. They're toxic to the marketplace, they're toxic to democracy.
That's not accurate. So why is Exxon what they are? Well, first of all, they lost money on refining in the fourth quarter. So this notion that somehow refiners are controlling markets is absurd. Why do you lose money? No. A refiner, for example, is like a baker. You don't control the price of bread, and you don't control the price of wheat.
But ExxonMobil is growing the wheat. They're shipping the wheat to the...
They're grinding the wheat.
They're retailing the wheat. They've got complete vertical integration.
They're taking a world price for crude oil. And, yes, they made money in crude. But if you look at how much the industry made in terms of earnings for the fourth quarter, it was about 6.7 cents in the dollar. If you look at the Dow Jones Industrial, it was 6.4. These are not earnings out of line with any other industry. So, yes, they're big companies, but they're fundamentally responding to markets. They're managing their business as possibly could.
Yeah,
you know,
I've heard that argument, and it's a difficult one to challenge other than to say then Exxon and Mobil maybe should go back to being Exxon and Mobil rather than Exxon
and
Mobil.
That makes no sense, because what you had with those mergers is a tremendous improvement in productivity. You had a strong reduction of costs. It occurred when oil was $10 a barrel and they had to do something.
So when are we, what's the position of the American Petroleum? We're talking with John Felmy. He's the chief economist for the American Petroleum Institute. What's your position on the carbon dioxide that's produced by using your products and the possibility that it might have be doing some really serious probability. I would say the certainty, but I'm curious your take on this, that it's doing some serious damage to this planet.
We're not talking about the science. All we're talking about right now in terms of our position is, as we move forward and people are talking about doing things about carbon, there's three broad options that you can look at. Mandates, you can look at carbon taxes, or you can look at cap and trade.
Well, there's a fourth, and that's technology, the sequestration.
Well, that's part of it, but you'd have to have a mandate to be able to get to that point in terms of mandating. But in terms of policy, those are the three, or subsidies, but you know, we'll put them in the same category. What you have is, what are the economic effects of those things? That's what we're talking about. Right now, you have a lot of discussion that we can do all these things, and it's uniformly positive. Well, we know that's not true. We know that there are national economic effects. We know there are state-level effects. You know, if you look at the different states, the carbon intensity of states varies by a factor of 10, Connecticut being the lowest, Wyoming the highest. And so you need to look at that.
Is that because of density of population?
No, it's because of the different fuels that they use. So, for example, you have the Midwest states, which use a lot of coal for electric generation. You've got more service-oriented states like Connecticut. And so you've also got industry impacts. You've also got...
Why has your industry, and why has ExxonMobil in particular, but there are several other companies, why have they funded the climate science deniers? Why have they funded the right-wing crazies and the right-wing think tanks that are out there saying things that actually may end up, I don't know if you have children or not, but may end up producing, I do, and may end up producing a hellish world for our kids and our grandchildren?
I don't speak for the individual companies in terms of what they do. The only thing I can tell you is that going forward in this discussion, we had better carefully look at what the economic impacts are, or we could drive this economy off a cliff even worse than what it is right now.
But
because
if
virtually
your planet
every,
is melting down, what good
well,
is an economy?
Well, but you've got to remember, if you unilaterally take a decision like the United States and China doesn't, you have worsened the situation. You will have largely destroyed your economy and increased emissions. We don't want to do that. So before we do,
do you think that the petroleum companies will start moving green? Into solar? I mean,
well,
I know
all,
BP big time in
they
solar.
They already are. If you look at the expenditures of the petroleum industry, they spend roughly about $42 billion, or about 45% of all expenditures on low carbon, no carbon investments in terms of what you're doing. So you've got BP that invests in solar.
So they're in the power industry, not in the carbon industry.
They're in the energy industry.
Yeah, they're not going to make the mistake the Western Union made when they were offered the telephone by Alexander Graham Bell. They said, no, sorry, we're in the telegraph business. Didn't get it that they were in the communications business. John Felmy, he is the chief economist for the American Petroleum Institute, API.org. John, interesting talking with you. Good talking with you.
Thanks
you
for having me.
Dropping by. We'll be right back.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We will be getting to your calls. It's just, you know, great people keep walking by. I want to engage in some of these conversations. Tim Graham is here with us. He's the Director of Media Analysis with the Media Research Center. This is the conservative media watchdog group, mediaresearch.org, the website. Tim, mm-hmm. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
And I'm looking at the media coverage of CPAC. Here we are at the Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington, D.C., for those of you who might have just tuned in. And the some of the major headlines that are being made. Joe the Plumber has suggested that members of Congress who oppose the war should be shot. And apparently he actually said something like that.
Oh,
John Bolton makes a joke about Iran nuking Chicago.
Okay.
And in fact, here's the clip of John Bolton. Stephanie.
Foreign policy. I don't think President Obama thinks it's a priority. He said during the campaign he thought Iran was a tiny threat. Tiny, depending on how many nuclear weapons they're ultimately able to deliver on target. It's tiny compared to the Soviet Union, but is the loss of one American city, pick one at random, Chicago, is that a tiny threat?
Yeah, I think... I think that this is either the fourth or fifth year I've done this conference. And last year, I believe it was, Bob Barr, who's been on this program many times, I've known Bob Barr for a lot of years, and who was the Libertarian candidate for president, and John Yoo,
mm-hmm.
the guy who wrote the torture policy, debated here. And... as John Yoo was going on and on and on about how we should basically throw the Constitution out the window, people were applauding. And Bob Barr was, frankly, horrified. He came on the air afterwards, and we had lunch together, and he said he was just horrified of that response. And I think that, you know, arguably Bolton, who's been on the program a number of times as well, called for blowing the... You know, he makes these jokes about blowing things up. Arguably, his statement that Iran shouldn't be considered a small threat if they can drop a nuke into Chicago is a serious statement and could be taken as such. But the response of the crowd was just like what I saw last year. It was people were applauding the idea of Chicago being blown up and laughing as if it was a joke. I don't get it.
Speaking on behalf of those who applauded, I don't think that's the way they took the remark. I think that what they were saying... No, but I'm saying, how did I react to it as I listened to it? I understand what he's basically saying is Barack Obama is somebody who doesn't see Iran as a serious threat. And I don't think when they say,
He did say it's a serious threat. He said it's not as big a threat as the Soviet Union or some other things.
I think that what the audience is hearing or what I heard in that was he was basically saying... Barack Obama doesn't take this country's security as seriously as we do. And there's a certain amount at a conference like this of sort of a team spirit. And sometimes that team spirit's going to sound like, what? But I think it's misinterpreting to say that they were cheering for the nuking of Chicago. I don't think any conservative would say, you know, Chicago's been nuked. This will be great for us. I mean, that's... No, the whole point of it, the whole point of what conservatives have tried to do is to keep the country safe. That's everybody's objective. And so, yeah, sure, we can have a debate about
Limbaugh says he wants Obama to fail. I mean, is that a piece of it? I mean, it, certainly, look at George W. Bush. His presidency was in the tank. He was considered an illegitimate president. Nobody really liked him much at all. 9/11 happens, and all of a sudden, he's sitting on top of the world. It was the best thing that could have happened. He had 56 specific warnings that was coming. Israel called him up and said, hey, we've got intelligence on this. Russia called him up and said, we got intelligence on this. He ignored all of it. The CIA sends a guy down to Crawford, Texas, along with Condi Rice, to specifically warn him on August 5th that this is coming. He blows it off, and he has this wonderful event. I mean, maybe it would be a good thing for conservatives. They'd be able to say, see, I told you so, if some god-awful thing, God forbid, were to happen.
Well, I'll speak for myself. That's a horrifying thought. I think that anybody who...
Then why is Limbaugh saying he hopes Obama fails?
He's not saying that he hopes the country gets blown up. He's actually saying, you know, what we'd like to see is we don't want to see socialism imposed by this president and this Congress.
Even if it succeeds?
Well, yeah, and we don't want successful socialism.
Why not? What if the standard of life in Sweden and in Denmark and in Norway and in France, for that matter, is a little more gentle form of socialism? What if the standard of living in those countries actually is better than our standard of living? People live longer, they have better lives, they have better quality of lives, they have greater social mobility. What's wrong with that?
We would say to you that they don't create jobs. I think if you looked at the way the Europeans have tried to create jobs over the last 20 years, they're not creating jobs. I mean, and these are stagnant societies, stagnant in population, you know, and probably with, I don't know for sure, but probably dropping in population. This country is exploding in population, and part of it is immigration. We can't sustain. I'm not sure we can sustain a socialist economy in this country. All I'm saying to you is we've got Newsweek magazine now saying we're all socialists. We're here at this conference saying, guess what? No, we're not all socialists now. We're going to fight this socialism.
Right. Okay. Well, so to the point of the media coverage, what's your take on how the media is covering this thing as we have just a minute here to wrap this up?
Well, yesterday MSNBC's David Schuster was basically mocking the idea that the conference was serious because it had Joe the Plumber as a spokesman. And I think the thing that I turn around to that and say, he is an average citizen. That's why they plucked him out, is because he was a regular citizen. And then I turn that around and say, look, our news media treated Cindy Sheehan as a very serious foreign policy pundit. And if they can do that, when a lot of conservatives thought she didn't really know what she was talking about in terms of...
Well, her son died in Iraq. That's a little different than happening to lie to a presidential candidate about having $250,000 to buy a business.
But I think the question here is expertise. And so, you know, we're basically pointing that out to say David Schuster made some very snotty remarks about CPAC not being serious and then turned around and watched Michelle Obama speak to the EPA and say, oh, her popularity's skyrocketing. So,
but
they
sound
like an official Democratic channel to us.
Not just MSNBC, but right across the board, you think?
The major media, other than Fox News, that's what we monitor.
Yeah, interesting. Okay. Tim Graham, the Director of Media Analysis, the Media Research Center. You can read all about it over at mediaresearch.org. Tim, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. Interesting to get your perspective.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to our third hour. Tom Hartman here, broadcasting live from CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference. Grace Marie Turner is with me. She is the president of the Galen Institute. Galen.org is the website, a not-for-profit health and tax policy research organization. Grace Marie, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tom. Pleasure to be with you.
Great to have you with us. And let me turn your mic up just a little bit there. I think that'll work a little better. On your website, it says, you start right out, surreal spending, audacity indeed, health policy newsletter.
Right, right.
Surreal spending was the title of one of our recent newsletters, but that doesn't begin to capture the unbelievable trillions of dollars that Congress and the Obama administration announced this week. And then you go into S-CHIP and all these other things. How is that any less audacious than Bill McGuire, the CEO of the second largest health insurance company in the United States, United Healthcare, taking $1.78 billion in personal compensation and doing that by denying millions of Americans health coverage?
I'm absolutely not going to defend that, but I think that we need to have consumers making decisions about their health care choices, including the kind of companies that they want to get their health coverage from, and they should be able to make the decision about whether they want to join a for-profit, a not-for-profit health insurance company. I'm not going to defend that. I'm defending choice for patients and doctors to be in charge of decisions, not to have so many billions and probably even trillions of dollars in federal money spent on health care without the American people being consulted about whether or not this is what they want.
But if my employer, who provides me with my health care, chooses United Healthcare,
what I think actually you should have other choices than having your employer get your health coverage for you, but we can talk about that.
Yeah, I don't disagree.
Right.
And I call up United Healthcare and I say, you know, I really don't like the idea of the fact that dollar bill is making a $1.7 billion and you're charging and my copay just went up $10 or
right.
whatever it is.
Right.
If I call them 2-3 times a day or 2-3 times a week or start yelling at them or go stand out in front of their office with a picket sign, they can have me arrested. If I don't like the way that Medicare is being delivered and I start picketing my elected officials or harassing them or even put a movement to get them thrown out of office, They not only can't have me arrested, they have to pay attention to me. How can you be opposed to a health care system that is run by we, the people, instead of a health care system that's run by billionaires like this weasel Bill McGuire?
Well, let's take that a little further. Do you really want to have to lobby members of Congress to get the coverage you want? Or do you want to vote with your feet and have portable health insurance that you own? You've decided what company you want to have. You're not going to have to be beholden either to your employer or to politicians about health care decisions. That's the kind of system I want, one in which doctors and patients are in charge, not bureaucracies, either public sector or private sector.
Well, I've tried voting with my feet for these many years. And, frankly, I'd rather be lobbying the members of Congress. And here's the reason why.
The system is stacked against you right now.
No, the system only has a 3% overhead built into it.
Well, let's talk about that number.
But, well, let's say it's 5%.
It's really 25%. When you add everything, Ben Ziker, former RAND Commission researcher, says when you count everything in the cost of government to run the Medicare program, 25% overhead.
But that assumes that you're going to shut down all the rest of government, which ain't going to happen.
No, it means that you're calling on the resources of the enforcement provisions, the tax collection provisions. It's turning on the computers to print out checks is not very expensive, but that is not the whole cost of Medicare. And
so
if you were to have the government run it, you're going to actually have government costing more than the private sector.
So your argument is that a private corporation that has to skim 10% off the top to pay dividends to shareholders, that's pulling over $1 billion out as compensation for its CEO and hundreds of millions of dollars for its other executives, it's got gold-plated faucets on the corporate jet.
I am defending
that marketplace is the one that I should go to for health care?
We do not have a properly functioning market in the health sector. What we need is a true marketplace.
How do we get
that?
We give
you choice. So you get to decide where you get your health insurance. You don't have to have it dictated either by politicians or by your employer. You get to make decisions about the kind of coverage you want and how much you
want
to pay for it.
What if I don't want to? What if, if I'm having a heart attack, I don't want to be calling five doctors and getting quotes.
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the insurance coverage that you have to protect yourself. If you do have that heart attack or you go to health insurance, that's something that you can make a decision about.
Here's my take on it. We're talking with Grace Marie Turner, the president of the Galen Institute, galen.org, and thank you so much for dropping by. My take on it is that when Jefferson wrote Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness into the Declaration of Independence,
right,
and the six, arguably seven, items listed in the preamble of the Constitution include the general welfare, that you can't have life if you can't recover from an illness. That life should be part of the commons, just like we have collectively agreed to have a socialist police department. We have collectively agreed that socialism works really well for our fire departments.
National, the part of defense and part of protecting Americans.
We have a socialist military. We all like that.
Right.
We have socialist National Guard
programs. And that's in the Constitution.
Programs.
We want to have protection. National defense is a constitutional authority. But
so is the general welfare.
Having government make decisions for you about what care you get or don't get, which is new federal health board that's part of the stimulus package would give you, isn't really going to give you choice and freedom. Certainly, we all need health insurance. And we need health coverage. But that's
I don't want choice and freedom as much as I want to be able to as the year that I lived in Germany, I could, and I did. I went into a hospital once, and I went into doctor's offices twice in that year that I lived there, and my kids did a couple of times. One was an injury, and the other was just something else, an infection. Every single time, you make the appointment. They typically would see you the same day. You walk in. They take care of you. They do whatever that needs to be done. They don't have 6-minute billing like we have here in the United States, or 15-minute billing like they've now gone to in Canada. They would see you for as long as they needed to see you. They would give you whatever medication you needed. You signed. You showed them your card, which was equivalent of a Social Security card. They took the number, and that was it.
Except
that
it's
painless.
Very, very high price they pay in taxes for that system. We actually have something.
I'm willing to pay for it.
We have something very similar right now in this country with these retail health clinics. You can just walk in, a lot less expensive than going to see a regular doctor. They're open 7 days a week, before work, after work. The private market can provide other options decisions for if people were in charge of decisions rather than the bureaucracy. You do not want to have.
Wait a minute.
The
you say rather than bureaucracy. Are you saying that there are no bureaucracies in corporations?
I'm saying that you should be able to make the decision of what kind of health and coverage umbrella you want for
so
yourself.
So what power are you giving
not
me to be able to?
You
what power are you giving me? We both agree that we have some ability to influence politicians. Far less than we should have, particularly given the current lobbying situation, but nonetheless. What kind of power do I have over a corporation?
You
other than the power to simply
vote
say...
Vote with your feet. If you don't like it, you can go someplace else. You cannot do that now.
But these are huge corporations.
You're locked into the system that your employer offers. If you had more choices, you could buy health insurance across state lines. If that tax subsidy that you get right now, invisible but very generous, were $250 billion a year in aggregate, were available to you directly, that provides a big floor and a big subsidy for you to begin to purchase health insurance. For people at the lower end of the income scale, they're going to need more help in purchasing that coverage.
Why? You know,
they should be able to make that decision, not politicians or bureaucrats.
You keep saying bureaucrats. I've done consulting. I used to own an ad agency. I've done training, consulting, and work with some of the largest corporations in America for a lot of years. And they are some of the most bureaucratic institutions in America.
Absolutely.
I mean, Dilbert makes fun of bureaucrats. The health insurance companies are full of bureaucrats. You don't want me dealing with their bureaucrats either?
The world is going to be different.
But they're not answerable to me.
Consumers in charge, they know you can't leave.
But here's
here's
the problem, Grace Marie. Grace Marie Turner, the president of the Galen Institute, I agree with you that competition is a good thing. I don't want the government making my shoes or my TV.
Good.
Why do they want them to have them in
charge of your life?
Because if I get sick with a really serious disease, it could cost millions of dollars.
Absolutely, which is why you need insurance.
It's why you need a large company. You need a large entity. If I could have in the state of Oregon where I live, 20 small health insurance companies competing for my business, I think that the world that you're talking about could come into existence. The problem is any one of those companies would go bust if you know, some small percentage of their people got really serious illnesses.
It would be good to have an actuary on your show because they say that you need a few tens of thousands of people in an insurance policy.
Then let's start enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act and break up these big companies.
That's a great idea. Give people more choices. Right now, you're trapped not only by your employer, but you're trapped by the rules and laws of your state. The state legislature said what your health insurance policy has to cover or not. Why should you have state legislators making those decisions for you?
So you're in favor of breaking up Blue Cross Blue Shield and United Healthcare?
I'm in favor of giving you choice and having the marketplace respond so that you get the kinds of choices you want to get the insurance protection you and your family need.
Great conversation. Grace Marie Turner, the president, the Galen Institute, galen.org is the website. Thanks for dropping by.
Thank you, Tom. Pleasure.
You give as good as you get. And perhaps better. I don't know. 16 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman radio program, 21 minutes past the hour. And I'm kicking guests out here. Enough. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Rick, what's on your mind today?
Well, I sympathize with you being in the belly of the beast there, but applaud your courage as well.
Well, it's, you know, I'm operating on the assumption that we're all human beings here and that we all actually care about this country and that there's just a fundamental difference in perspective. And I think if you start from that point, then these conversations actually can be very enlightening for both sides.
That's true. But, see, I respected even Ronald Reagan. I admit I voted for him twice. I voted for Richard Nixon. I used to respect people like William Buckley before he passed away, obviously, and Jack Kemp I had respect for, and Chuck Hagel, people like that. But when I, and this is a new one, now you're telling me Joe the plumber says anybody that disagreed with the war should be shot?
Yeah. Well,
that's a new one.
Yeah.
I heard Bolton's remarks.
And I'm echoing a couple of your callers there that that Sean Hannity has on his website three different
ways.
Well,
apparently the thing on Hannity's website was put up by one of his listeners. And so, you know, that's kind of a cheap shot because, frankly, you know, somebody listening to the show could put something like that up on my website as well, on my message board. And that doesn't mean that it's my idea or that I even knew about it, you know.
But I do think that we as liberals, when we extol free speech, and we should, it's like one of the callers said in the first hour, this sort of thing, free speech is fine as long as you don't yell fire in a crowded theater when there's no fire. And I do think there is a limit, and I think some of these folks are crossing that line. And I think at the very least, and I know you disagree with me, but at the very least, we do need to implement this fairness doctrine. There was nothing wrong with the fairness doctrine. When they took that away, that's when all this right-wing talk radio began to proliferate. And I think
I'm not opposed to the old fairness doctrine. You know, and I've, since we did the show on this a couple of weeks ago, I've done my homework and actually, you know, tracked it back, and there never was one specific written down thing. And in fact, in all the years that the Fairness Doctrine existed, the FCC never once proactively went out and said to a radio station, are you being fair? And there was only one charge against a radio station that actually stuck, and that was brought by a listener. So, you know, it had to do with programming in the public interest. This is a straw man, what these conservatives are talking about with the Fairness Doctrine, where they're going to have some bureaucrat listening to my show and deciding how liberal I am and how conservative, you know, Hannity is, or Limbaugh actually is the one I'm opposite, or O'Reilly. And,
O'Reilly's all done, by the way, on the radio.
Yeah, I know.
But the thing is, Tom, I do think, and you made the example of how Bill Clinton, at least domestically, it was to the right of Richard Nixon. Yeah. This is not the Republican Party anymore. This is not conservatives. These people are, I think, at least semi-fascist.
They're right-wing really crazies. Yeah, but
and
here's the bottom line, and here's the magic secret, or the dirty little secret of how it all works, Rick. The way the radio works is it's a barter business. My radio show is given to radio stations. They have to carry 5 network minutes of our show, you know, that goes along with our show. We make our money by selling those 5 network minutes. The radio station makes their money by selling their local advertising.
Sure.
If the radio station is owned by a parent corporation that also owned, for example, my show, none of them are, but if they did, then they would not only make all the money on the local minutes, they would also make all the money on those 5 national minutes, which is 300 minutes a month, which on some of these big 50,000-watt stations around the country, you're talking millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars a year. The network would make that. And that's the situation that we have with several networks, is they own the radio stations and they own the talent. And that's why that's the only talent that ever shows up on those stations. And we confronted this with the movie business back 30 years ago, 40 years ago, and laws were passed that said it's illegal for the companies that make the movies to also own the theaters. And frankly, I think that's something that we should consider. But that I think is the, you know, but I'll leave it at that. That's, you know, enough on the Fairness Doctrine. Mike, which is why, again, I think that the Fairness Doctrine, the straw man that the conservatives are putting out is it's just there for, they're just hoping that we will kick that or throw them into the briar patch or whatever the metaphor is. Mike in Seattle. Hey, Mike, what's up?
First off, it was Lech Walesa that brought down the Soviet Union, but that's not why I called.
You know, I agree. You're right. But see, you could also argue that he was a symptom, not a cause, because what was bringing down the Soviet Union was the fact that they had a dysfunctional economic system.
Yeah, and you're right there, too. But remember that old line from Clinton, it's the economy, stupid?
Yep.
We need to change it to, it's world peace, stupid. And we can make so much more money off of peace than we can war. And you can go and do it better than I can, but just simply, if you kill somebody, you can't sell anything to them. And to be real honest, I don't hear the word peace coming out of Obama's mouth often enough.
Yeah.
It didn't come out through the campaign. It's not coming out. He's got Clinton out there waving the big stick.
You know, the two presidents who tirelessly talked about peace were the two who fought in World War II and saw it up hand, close and personal. Jack Kennedy, who was badly wounded in World War II, and Dwight Eisenhower.
You're right.
And I would venture to guess that at least one out of every 3 speeches those guys made had peace as a major center point. And they both gave major, major speeches on peace. You're absolutely right. And peace has, Mike, and peace has been has been portrayed or characterized as somehow, you know, this flaky new agey thing. And as John Kennedy so brilliantly pointed out back in 62, I think it was, at Michigan State University, peace is essential for the survival of humanity. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. I was just reading an email I got from a guy who knew my dad when they were kids. And I shouldn't do that when I'm about to go on the air. He says, just wanted to talk to you a little bit about your dad, Carl. I lived in Newaygo and graduated from Newaygo High School about 4 or 5 years behind your dad. And then he talks about how they kept in touch and they were good friends. And at the very end, he says, your Aunt Marilyn, that's my dad's sister, told me about you, about your books and your radio show. I've listened to you a few times. I hear his voice in you. After checking out our website, I see him in your eyes. Enough rambling. Just wanted to remind you what a kind, generous man he was. As if you don't remember, he made a lifelong impression on my life. That's amazing. Jerry, thank you, if you're listening, for that email. And 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Jay in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Jay, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom.
What's up? Jay, if you got us on a speakerphone, can you pick it up, please?
Sorry about that.
Jay, you there?
Yes.
Okay, what's on your mind?
Excuse me for my enunciation. I have Parkinson's, so please bear with me.
Oh, okay, no problem.
Are you familiar with the prosperity programs as well as the farm settlement and the programs such as that were done mostly throughout up until about the late 90s?
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard of those?
I missed the first part of your sentence. I'm sorry. When the engineer just here at CPAC came up to me and asked me,
okay,
interrupted.
I'm wondering if you are familiar with the prosperity programs that includes the farm settlements?
Yes. Well, I'm not, you know, I'm not any kind of expert. I'm familiar, you know, I remember the words about them, but I don't, you know, no, I don't. I can't say that I'm really familiar with them.
Well, what's your point? It's called Freedom, and it was done in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a blocked, the payouts ever since 2001 by up until now the Bush administration. I was wondering, do you have any ideas of how we might go to find out more information about, or because now there's all kinds of disinformation flying around against Obama.
Yeah. Yeah.
Stating that he's a block in it, which I don't believe.
Yeah. Jay, I don't know anything about the details of that. If you want to post some information over at TomHartman.com on our blog, I do read that every day or nearly every day. And occasionally I'm traveling or something, I just can't get to it. But and Sean reads it, and Louise reads it. So, you know, we'll see what we can track down. And thank you for the call. I appreciate it. And thank you for waiting, by the way, so long to go on the air. Kim in San Francisco. Hey, Kim, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. First of all, I want to say I worship you. I'm like a Hartman groupie.
Oh.
And if you remember the Compton as God, I'm going to start a Hartman as God thing. But I don't like you there, Tom, and I'll tell you why.
All right.
Because it's sort of you're taking on the attitude that these I've listened to a couple of years when you go to CPAC, and the reason why I don't like it is those people love the whole Beltway game and it's a game,
yeah.
And my feeling is we the American people are living in what is basically the rubble that their free market ideas that were thrust upon us have left us in. We live in these neighborhoods with vacant houses.
Kim.
We live. And these vacant houses are in danger of being broken into for their copper.
Yeah, Kim.
We're living
Kim,
in a scavenger society because
Kim, I agree. I agree. But let me just respectfully disagree with you on one point. The Beltway game crowd, by and large, are not the true believers that I've been looking for and try to put on this show. They are the politicians. And this it's one of the reasons why you will rarely hear a politician on this show. Because they're the get-along, go-along crowd. They're the ones who are cutting the compromises. They're the ones who are making the deals. I think we need to be lobbying our politicians as individuals, as citizens. I think that we need to be, you know, pressuring them. We need to be electing good people to political office. We need to fundamentally change how the system works, particularly with regard to campaign financing, so that we don't have get-along, go-along. But
it's those people that you're around right now that have left us in this situation.
Yeah.
It is their policies. Where is their...
And I'm trying to point it out to them, Kim. I'm trying to point it out to them. No,
you
I get it.
I get it.
Yeah, and I am doing my best, and I will continue to. Kim, thank you for the call, and thanks for your kind words. Jennifer in New York City. Hey, Jennifer.
Hi, Tom. I'm a long-time listener, even from your launch. And I wanted to talk a little bit about what you said Bolton said about Obama not thinking that Iran's nukes are a small threat.
Yeah.
Well, I'm reading a book called The Devil We Know by Robert Baer, and I think you already had him on the show once.
Yes, he's been on the show several times.
And as an ex-CIA agent, he says in his book that Iran realizes not to push the subject of nukes because they're already winning wars and territories by proxy.
Yep.
And that asymmetrical war is working better for them right now.
That's right.
Installing Hezbollah's and then denying any involvement.
Yeah, plus the number one mullah in Iran who's... Is it Sistani? Or, no, that's the guy in Iran. I mix up my mullahs, but in any case,
me too.
the number one religious authority, who really is the guy who ultimately is making many of the decisions in Iran, has interpreted the Quran as saying that a weapon of mass destruction of the proportions of an atomic bomb is against Sharia law. So
right, and
they wouldn't
they
even
don't
do it.
Really, they're not pursuing it quite as as these people like Bolton think.
No, but there's a
hysteria.
And
they're actually winning territories. They've already annexed the northern part of Iraq and the whole south of Iraq.
You're right. I mean, we handed it to them on a platter when we took out Saddam Hussein. It's just...
Yeah,
it's,
you know what? We basically helped them by doing what we did. They probably were just like, mwah.
Yeah, exactly. Please don't throw us in that briar patch. Oh, here we are. Hey, not bad.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so they're winning.
Yeah.
They're winning. I don't agree with whatever they're doing, and now they're trying to control the whole area by going in, they're going to do the same thing in Turkey according to this guy.
Yeah. And
this Bolton is an idiot.
Yeah.
Why is this not getting out to the public? I don't understand that.
I think the public has figured out their game, Jennifer, of the world. I think so, yeah. I think that they're being widely ridiculed.
I hope so, because I wish I had more faith in it.
Yeah.
I really do.
I think that's why the guy
from
the Media Institute, the Media Research Institute or whatever it is that we had on a little earlier, who's all freaked out because all the corporate media, all the mainstream media, he refers to it as, are are making fun of the conservatives here at CPAC. Well, the reason why is because some of them are pretty damn ridiculous, and some of their ideas are downright destructive. Jennifer, I've got to move along. Thank you so much for the call, though. Great to hear from you. Alex in New Brighton, Michigan. Hey, Alex, what's up?
Oh, hi.
You're on the air, Alex.
It's actually New Brighton, Minnesota.
Oh, I'm sorry. I see MI on my, and then the rest of it kind of scrolled off the screen.
Oh, gotcha.
No problem.
All right. Well, this was partially in follow-up to a call. I actually called in here several weeks ago, but as I was listening on hold, there were a couple of other things that came to my mind.
Okay.
So, first of all, I was the guy who called in a little while back taking issue with your categorization of George Bush as fitting the profile of a serial killer based on that Bush on the Couch book.
Right. Did you pick it up and read it?
I have been looking into it, and I discovered while I was reading some of it, for one thing, that this Dr. Frank fellow has never even met George Bush.
That's right.
And that his information is completely secondhand, which puts it at questionable credibility, including some specific things that gentleman you had on said. Like, for example, Bush was sent away soon after the death of his sister and had very little contact with his parents through his teenage years. That's absolutely not true. He went to boarding school starting in 10th grade when he would have been 15 or 16. His sister died when he was 7. He was very close with his parents growing up. I've been reading a reference book called The Complete Book of U.S. Presidents, Presidents by William A. DiGregorio.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely no ideological axe to grind.
Right.
You want to find out anything about any president, this guy will give you the
Alex,
good, the bad,
let me just
and
ask you
about
a question.
Every Republican
if
and Democratic
Bush,
president we've ever had.
That's fine. If Bush doesn't have narcissistic personality disorder, then why did he make jokes about putting people to death?
I'm not familiar with that particular comment.
Okay, I would suggest you track down Tucker Carlson, the conservative commentator to whom Bush made that joke, and I'm sure you can find lots of references to it. I mean, it's not the only one, but he was one of the most outspoken about how totally creeped out he was by it. We'll be right back.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Hey, thanks so much to Louise Hartman, to our executive producer, Sean Taylor. A special thanks, because, we're saying goodbye, I guess, today. But I'll be back here on Monday with you, our listeners. But Air America and I are going in different directions. And so I want to say a special thanks to some people that I really honor and really loved working with. Shelley Whiteman, who is running the board, and Shelley Osterberger, and Marcus Hillman, and Michael McDonald, and Amy Winslow, some just absolutely wonderful people at Air America Radio. And to Sue Nethercutt, who runs our chat room, and all the folks in our chat room, to Mike Toth, who does our audio archives, to Alva Goldbook, who is doing our video archives, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. Thanks so much. And 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Danny in Wenatchee, West, Washington. Hey, Danny, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. I certainly have enjoyed your show from the CPAC convention. I just wanted to comment on the healthcare discussion.
Mm-hmm.
I saw Dr. Howard Dean earlier this week on MSNBC talking about that, and I agree with him. He says the key to healthcare reform is Medicare, and he says until they offer the option of Medicare to people under 65 to buy in, that they're not going to solve this problem.
Right. No, we need Medicare for everybody in the country. I mean, it's and this
well,
was
just offering it as an option. That,
right.
That
let people buy into
65.
It. Yeah. Let people buy into it. Absolutely.
Yes.
Yep.
Absolutely.
We're going to continue taking calls here until the end of the hour, Marcus and Stephanie. 866-303-2270. Danny, thank you very much for that call. Jim in San Jose. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind today?
Hey, thank you. I want to talk to you about medical marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
And very quickly, I think it would be a good idea to have it like it's maybe temporary. No, allow it temporarily, but what we really need to do is find out what are the active ingredients in there, distill it, and regularize it. Because right now,
I think they've done that. The primary active ingredient is 9-delta tetrahydrocannabinol, also known as THC, and you can buy. There's a brand name for it. I mean, I don't even think they're synthesizing it. I think they're just extracting it. And you can buy it as pills. I mean, it's pharmaceutical.
Marinol, I think it's called
Marinol. Yeah, Marinol, right, yeah.
But as I said, that would be a better way of going because that's regularized when you smoke a joint. You really don't, you can't control the dosing.
Yeah, when it's used as medicine, I agree with you. There should be some standardization, shall we say, of it. On the other hand, this is a weed that naturally grows all over the world, in the kind of climates that we have. Doesn't grow so well in rainforests or in the Arctic. But I think it's crazy that we're trying to say it's illegal to grow a weed in your backyard that normally grows in your backyard.
And just legalize it.
Yeah, that's just, it's like...
I agree with you there. It was
legal in 1776. The Declaration of Independence and the Constitution were written on paper made from hemp. Now, it may not have been marijuana. It might have been more the hemp variety, but George Washington grew hemp. But certainly marijuana was not unknown to the founders. It was common. It wasn't criminalized until the early part of the 20th century, Harry Anslinger and his whole thing. And that was in part in a response to the economic pressure from the cotton industry that saw it as a threat. You had the wood products industry that saw it as a threat. You had Harry Anslinger trying to build an empire and being an opportunist, using racial stereotypes and racist kinds of the whole reefer madness stuff. If you keep this stuff legal and black guys will smoke it and they'll want to rape white women. I mean, that was the message that was being promoted in the 20s and 30s to criminalize pot. And it's just crazy. And so I agree with the folks at NORML, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, that it should be decriminalized. And I agree with you, Jim, that for medical purposes, it should be standardized. Lee in Anaheim, California. Hey, Lee, what's up?
Hi. Okay, I'm just responding a little bit late to what Bernie Sanders and you were talking about a while back about the Scandinavian countries.
Mm-hmm.
So about the past 15, 16 years, I've been living in Denmark and Sweden and very anxious to get back to America. Medical care was pretty good. But I think they've gone too far with housing and education and daycare and all these things. Because, it really does change the character of the people there in many ways. Like my daughter, who has been through all these things, has absolutely no sense of competition.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that can be, I think some of the effects of being looked after too well can really change the attitudes of the people toward a little bit less what we consider the American system. So I'm kind of a little fearful, even though I'm very much in favor of the medical changes that Obama wants to make. I just say we shouldn't admire the Scandinavian countries too much because I think if you lived there for a long time, you'd be really anxious to get back to America, where things are a lot looser and freer and not as
But speaking as somebody who grew up here, I mean, I had that kind of culture shock the year that I lived in Germany. I just thought it was going to be like America, only I spoke German. And I was astounded at how different the culture was.
It's so different.
But Germans come over here, and they're astounded at how different our culture is. I think that there is a conversation, Lee, and you really touched on the center point of it, and that is, what kind of a society do we want to have? What kind of world do we want to live in? And I think it's a fascinating one. It's an important one that we need to be bringing up. And is that American competitive, the Thomas Edison, the Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett, is that necessarily the healthiest thing if it leaves a lot of casualties in its wake? Or on the other hand, maybe it's the most successful thing to build a great nation. I don't have a, I'm not taking a position on either side. I think that it's a conversation
that
we should have.
I've taken a position.
Yeah, I got it. I got it. But you're in favor of the competitive nature of it. Lee, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. I do appreciate it. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. And let's see here. Coming up on Monday, Carrie Lucas is going to be with us, the Independent Women's Forum, and Andy Hyman, Senior Program Officer at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. But anyhow, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you on Monday. Have a great weekend.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.